It's always interesting when after a break, there's just a moment when everybody knows it's ready to go back to our lessons, and suddenly everything shifts, and there's a silence, and everybody immediately, all of a sudden, we're back into our kind of exploration mode. And that's what we're doing, really, is we are exploring. If we use the analogy of an artist is always exploring, trying something new, never afraid of failure. And one of the main differences between mystical living and living a more materialistic life is this idea of failure. You cannot fail mystically, because there's only the one. And if you realize that there is no downside to trying things, as long as you're motivated through love and through, you know, this desire to understand the nature of life, then that's what we're here for, is to expand this spiritual experience. I said I'd tell you a story. Well, when I mentioned that, you know, when we have a spiritual experience, it releases us. And I think we've all of us here have had at least one, or we wouldn't be here. We have had a time when we were absolutely up against whatever the problem was, and then suddenly there was a release, there was a insight there, and with that lots of times comes tears or comes an emotional response, and it's very cleansing. So that area, when I was 17, I came to a class in Hawaii of Joel's, and on Maui I had an experience of what we were talking about in the first session. It was consciousness, and the whole class was on the I, and that all of a sudden there was the realization that comes when we are in a group where our intent is to know the truth, our intent is to experience the spiritual consciousness. When there is that oneness of purpose, then you can go deeper into your own makeup and access this dimension of consciousness that is always within you. So when that happened to me in a class of Joel's on Maui, it was just like a complete wave of emotion, and the emotions go through you, and then they move you into another realm of experience. I'll talk about emotions a little bit, because emotions are important. They're an important part of who we are, and lots of times they're misunderstood spiritually, because that emotional part of us, which is really the feeling part of us, we feel this presence. And lots of times it takes a discernment to realize, is this presence that I'm feeling just kind of an emotional uplift that's coming out of the world, or is this an experience of consciousness that is lifting me and showing me the joy that life is? Because two things about living spiritually. One is that it is joyful. And number two, it has a great purpose. Our purpose in being aware of consciousness is to dissolve the limitations of material belief, a material concept. So how do we access that? This was the this part, this lesson is accessing that. And that's a very interesting word. It was, again, something that was on a tape that Joel was mentioning recently, using that word, and it never had stuck in my mind before. But we do access this consciously, this consciousness. Because our conditioning is such that things of spirit are either relegated to when you're getting married or when you're dead at a funeral or maybe when you're christened, but kind of in between. It's always out there and it's not that relevant to your everyday life, which is a complete misnomer, because without the conscious awareness of this presence, you are not accessing, you're not letting this consciousness function in your life. So the primary means of access is meditation, because we cannot experience consciousness mentally. Now, that kind of sounds like an oxymoron, because, well, everything is coming through the mind. When we meditate, we still the mind. But maybe we need to define the mind. What is mind? Mind isn't a product of your brain. Mind isn't your thought process, because thoughts are universal. Thoughts are like energy airwaves that are, you know, sound waves that are just, they're floating in this arena of existence. I'm sure that animals have thoughts. You can see them. We have a whole family of birds. They're our pets, and you can see almost their thought process. We can have the doors closed and be in the kitchen, and there'll be a minor bird come up on a chair and look in and want some breakfast, and we can be watching it, and in my mind, and I'm Saunders, I know we've talked about this, I can say, well, what do you want? And suddenly the minor bird, and this is just all mentally, picks up, they know what's going on. And if they don't want to be seen, and if they think they're hiding, and you're behind, you know, something, and you're looking at them, they'll pick up your gaze, and they'll look around, and they'll go, oh, and they'll get frightened and fly away. So there's thought that goes on every level of life, from the most simple of creatures to human beings. So thought cannot be generated from the human brain. Thought is something that is universal, and thought is an activity, is a universal activity that is picked up by mind. Now, there is only one mind. That mind is the term that really is the arena or the level of consciousness of this particular state of being. And the thoughts would be different depending on your state of being, depending on your species. I'm imagining that the thoughts of animals are reflected human thoughts. If the human environment where the animals are is one of love and one of no threat, you find animals behaving in a loving manner. And if you are on the internet at all, you've probably seen all these wonderful little videos of how loving and kind animals are, even species that are supposed to be enemies and predators. So there's an environment that is created, and that environment that we pick up mentally is this mind realm. And the mind realm then, so when you're in this mind realm and thoughts are coming to you, you're picking up a universal belief structure. And you know, one of the definitions of this world is the belief in the power of good and evil. Now, this goes back to Genesis in the Western tradition, where you had the myth of creation. And the myths, in a way, are the agreed upon mental atmosphere that a society or a whole culture accepts. In the different societies, the ancient Greeks had their myths, the Egyptian had their myths. Really, in our Judeo-Christian, we have the same myth. We have a myth that says that the earth was, that man was created in the image and likeness of God out of the dust of the ground. Now that is a myth. And that the foundation for that myth is that people, a society, wanted to connect with something higher than themselves. They felt inadequate. And you find that in many different societies. When I studied Hawaiian culture in college, they had basically the same mythology. Their ali'i, their rulers could trace their heritage, their ancestry, back to the gods. So we all have this desire to trace our ancestry, our origins, back to the gods. And when it comes through and developing awareness, we get all these great stories. So in our Western story, we have the Garden of Eden, and we have Adam created out of the dust of the ground, and women created out of Adam's rib. Well, you can tell the kind of society it was. Women were not very well respected in that society. And in this early mythology. And so in the garden, God tells Adam to identify everything, name everything, name all the plants, name all the animals. So in naming, what does naming do? Naming is judgment. You name something, and then you say, oh, well, this plant is good, we can eat this. Don't eat that plant, you'll get sick and die. This animal is good, they'll help you out. Stay away from that animal, because if they bite you, you'll die. So we have this whole creation of life, this myth of life, saying that there are good things in this world and there are bad things in this world. So where did that come from? None of that is coming from consciousness. None of that is coming from spiritual reality. And so you have then this idea that there are two trees. So there's somebody in this storytelling. Because all of our, I mean, that's just how we evolve and grow as a society, through stories. Storytellers, if they're illumined, will start elevating a society and moving them out of a very repressive type of a myth. And in our Western tradition, we have a number of wonderful stories that break the myth of the belief that there is power in the concepts of good and evil. So in the Garden of Eden, we have two trees. We have the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and we have the tree of life. Now it's interesting. The knowledge of good and evil isn't life. The tree of life is different. The tree of life, when you experience the tree of life, you are taken out of the myth. You are taken out of the garden. And you are experiencing the consciousness of oneness, the consciousness of knowing. the experiencing, the fullness of life. But the knowledge of the tree of good and evil was forbidden, because if these creatures, if mankind, knew good and evil, then society would always be in conflict. The idea, the hope, the dream was, oh, if we don't know about good and evil, we'll have a society that is harmonious. And you had a society of two, a man and a woman. You'd think that it would be able to be harmonious without jillions of people. But no, there was temptation. And it came through a woman. Again, written by a man. And the serpent tempted the woman and said, you need to eat of that tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the woman did. And she came back to the man and said, oh, you won't believe it. I mean, how wonderful. Look at it. We know everything. We're like gods. And that kicked them out of paradise. And man has been trying to get back to paradise ever since. Human beings. Now, we're all connected to this myth, whether we accept it, whether, you know, it's just part of our culture. And we're still dealing with it because it involves peoples from such different belief structures, because the Muslims have the same myth. The Jews have the same myth. All the different Christian sects have the same myth. It is this same myth that we are tempted by some force, some temptation to be as God. And if we are as God, then we will know good and evil. And what does that do to our access to consciousness? It puts this subconscious sense, we can't be God. We're human beings. We're born and we're going to die, and our life is boxed in by this myth. And to think that we could be like God is, look what happened to Eve and Adam. But it's a complete misinterpretation of the spiritual reality that God is the substance of all form. So our access then, through meditation, and we started this with meditation in the mind. So we, this mental realm that we live in is a realm of the belief of good and evil. Now, I just gave our Western myth. You can go into the East and you can have the same myth. You can go into Africa. You can go into different native cultures. You can go almost to human beings around the planet and you will find a similar myth. This is what Joseph Campbell's great contribution to humanity was. He said, there's only one myth. And it is the myth that we're separated from our spiritual source. So, when we understand the myth, we can put it in its place, and it loses its power. Once you understand something that's been kind of obscure and frightening, you stay away from it, you don't want to deal with it, and it affects, it takes away your freedom. You don't have complete freedom. Once you see something for what it is, and the sense of power and mystery is taken away, you gain freedom. So, accessing spiritual consciousness requires the ability to become still mentally, because it is only in that complete mental stillness that you're in the now moment. When the mind is functioning, it's always in the past or the future. It's only when the mind is still that you're in the now. And that now moment brings with it an incredible stillness. Doesn't matter if you're talking, it doesn't matter if you're doing something. When you're in that now moment, you have a stillness. Because that stillness is the atmosphere of consciousness. And so when you feel that stillness, that consciousness, you acknowledge it because you put your attention to it. And you acknowledge it consciously. It's not like, oh, isn't that strange? Or, gosh, I'm feeling that, and then you go on about your business. No, you consciously address, acknowledge, ah, spiritual consciousness, that is what I am. Oneness. That consciousness is infinite. That consciousness is eternal. Am I going to identify with a material concept, or do I identify with consciousness? No, I identify with this consciousness. That's who I am. And that way I can then, now I'm free. Now I'm free to look at what's going on mentally. I'm free to look at the belief of good and evil. The belief that there is power in material cause and effect. So I have to have an awareness of mind. I have to know how mind in general works. Since I am accessing this consciousness in the now moment through a still mind, what is a still mind? Is the still mind in me the same as the still mind in you? Do we all have different minds? No, there's only one mind. Now we experience the one mind through our conditioning. And in that context, it's all different. We've all grown up in different parts of the world, different parts of the country. We all have had different families. Some families very religious, some families not. Some families very free and open. Other families very fearful and restrictive. So our conditioning through our experience is how that we view this one mind or experience this one mind. So when we are in the past, we are bringing up all of our human conditioning. And if our human conditioning has been painful, if it's been suffering, then we're bringing that into this mind, which basically is inert. Doesn't have any qualities to it at all. It's like giving a quality to a radio wave. You know, the radio picks up a radio wave. It's what's been being broadcast through that wave, whether it's beautiful music or whether it's hate speech or whether it is whatever it is. So when that which is happening in this benign mental state, we pick it up, and through judgment we create a certain attitude. So when the mystical masters, what was one of the basic principle of accessing this consciousness is judge not. Judge not, lest ye be judged. Judge righteous judgment. Well, righteous judgment is the ability to look at the concepts of good and evil, the beliefs of good and evil, and say, this is created by human experience, this is myth, and this really has no power. If I need to understand it, the understanding will come. I can start seeing through the behavior or whatever it is that seems to be affecting what's going on. But the belief in a power that is based on a myth is not mystical. It will not lead you to freedom. In one of my writings, I had a character, a line, and she's an atheist. And she says, you know, I don't believe in Jehovah. any more than I believe in Diana or Athena or Mars or Jupiter. And that really is the state of belief. If we, at one time, people believed in Mars and believed in Diana and had built temples to her and prayed to her. People believed in Jehovah as a power out there. Now, sometimes the path to mysticism takes you through a complete rejection of, quote, faith, of religion. I no longer believe in a rewarding and punishing God. That's the Jewish God. That's the God that made a contract with mankind and said, if you do this, I will bless you. But if you do that, I will curse you. Now, this is the foundation of our society, for better or for worse. We have a mindset that says we have to be, that we will be rewarded if we're good, whoever's concept of good we are in, and we will be punished if we do bad. Now, many Western countries are moving out of that concept. There was a documentary that Michael Moore did about in Europe and in Germany, the way they treat criminals is completely different than in America. And when the American prison leaders went to Germany and were talking, the German prisons, people had their own rooms, they could cook, they had all kinds. I mean, it was like they were separated from society, but they were not being punished. And the American prison, the warden says, well, you're not, these people are like living in a country club. And he says, well, we have a different approach. We're not approaching our criminal element with the idea of punishment. We approach it with the idea of rehabilitation. What is our goal? Our goal is to bring people back into society so that they can live productive lives. And the American was saying, our whole idea is that if you break the law, you're punished. So our whole prison system is built on punishment. So that is a direct correlation of this rewarding and punishing God. You do something wrong, you're going to get punished. Where is forgiveness? Where is compassion? Now, if you want to take it from the religious standpoint, that's a very Old Testament idea. When Jesus came along, he said, forgive 70 times 7. Love your enemies. Do good to those who curse you. Bless those who profane your name. Why? Because you take away the power of this strong concept of reward and punishment. And you do that because you realize that all of us are consciousness. Whether the awareness of that consciousness is so buried deep within the individual that he behaves, you know, as a criminal, that individual still is consciousness. Consciousness recognizing that spiritual consciousness, realizing that right where that individual stands is the fullness of spiritual manifestation, removes that limitation and that judgment of good and evil. That is our primary function as mystics, is to recognize, in using biblical terms, recognize the Christ, recognize that spiritual oneness in all we meet. So, we have to practice, we have to be masters in this mystical living. And to do that, we not only develop our access to this consciousness through our ability to get into the now moment and our ability to quiet the mind. Now, we look at the mind then as we start experiencing that presence and that peace. That is our indication that we are in this consciousness, that we are functioning out of infinite consciousness, eternal life, is that we have a sense of peace and there is very little fear. We move into this world from this standpoint of peace, and we can look at everything without reacting. We can look at disease, we can look at crime, we can look at man's inhumanity to man and not react, because we realize that that is taking place in this realm of mind. That is taking place, and it's universal. You can't say that criminals are from one race or one country or one part of the world. You have all these different levels of behavior and identification universally. So we have to start taking all of the appearances away. And this was from Jesus, judge not after appearances. What is the appearance? Oh, a woman taken in adultery, a prostitute. Oh, can't judge her for that. Or the Pharisees, you can't judge them. They think they're so good. A lot of people judge self-righteousness as a sin. Oh, you can't judge self-righteousness. You can't judge those who think they're good. You can't judge big egos. You can't judge liars. You can't judge any of these people by the appearance. If you judge by the appearance, you have fallen into that level of life that is the realm of conflicting forces, to put a metaphysical term on it. So we're aware then of this mental level, and we're able then to separate that in a way so that we have our access in consciousness. And that separation is through judgment. It is detachment. We might be seeing all of these people behaving in all these different ways, but inwardly we're just seeing ourself. Not ourself as a manifestation, not ourself as a mental, physical presentation, but ourself as immortal life, eternal life. Ourself as love, life expressing as love, as compassion, as forgiveness. I've had people come and say, you know, I can't forgive. That person did wrong me so badly, I can't forgive them. Well, you're talking from this concept of good and evil, of conflicting forces. And nobody's going to ask you to forgive. You know, I of myself can do nothing. Now that of the greatest gift that Christ consciousness brought us, that Jesus brought us, was I of myself can do nothing. It is the Father within, the Spirit within, that doeth the work. His descriptions of this entailed the idea or concept of Father God, but that was a very Jewish thing, and it helped perpetuate. That's why Joel said, gosh, if Jesus just had used consciousness, everybody has consciousness. Well, everybody has a father. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have a father. But that father is always viewed as not you, it's out there. But when the Father within, thou seest me, thou see the Father within, he was saying, look beyond this heritage, look beyond this race, look beyond this culture or this class, and there's very differing ideas of who Jesus was. Was he a very working class, humble, poor carpenter? Or was he a prince? Was he descended from the line of David? Was his background not just a carpenter, but a builder, an architect, someone who had a higher status in society? We don't know, but we look through all of those appearances, all of those prejudices that we accept through our mind. Now, why do we accept all this? It's, you know, if I can't forgive somebody, it isn't my position to forgive. In, you know, forgiveness isn't the same as pardon. A human being can pardon somebody else. A government can pardon somebody. But is that forgiveness? Forgiveness really is the removal of any sense of condemnation, the removal of any judgment, until all there is the realization and recognition of this one consciousness. So we, part of our access then, in this attaining the stillness in meditation, is to constantly detach ourselves from the thoughts that come into our awareness. It is the realization that material sense of I, that conceptual sense of I, that I that identifies with gender and race and class and age and all of those apparent physical concepts, is not anything but illusion. And then what takes place is that the mind naturally, our individual sense of mind, naturally calms. The thought process naturally calms. The sense of time starts to diminish, and time becomes now. We're existing in the moment. We're not projecting into the future. Now, this takes self-awareness, and there's nothing wrong with examining your reactions and understanding your conditioning. Because a lot of our reaction is based on conditioning, and a lot of this conditioning is deep-seated. A lot of this conditioning is relative to our age, when we grew up. Society has changed in the last 60 years tremendously. Those who are younger do not have the same baggage. They might have different baggage. I'm not saying that the human sense of life is growing more spiritual, but it is changing. And to probe that change and to be aware of how society has changed and how that change affects you. A lot of people, any kind of change is unpleasant. It's frightening. It's I've never done it this way. Why should I do it this way if I've never done it this way? What is that indicating? And you are aware if these tendencies happen to you, because it's part of this omniscient consciousness is always basically revealing the truth. So if you're attuned and aware of your own perceptions, you'll find yourself saying, oh, I really don't like change. Oh, I like to do this always the same way. All right. Well, now is that a judgment? Are you going to say that's good or bad? No, forget judgment. We're not talking about judgment on this, but we're talking about being aware of how we react and how we respond to that which comes into our mind. Now, everything we experience comes into our mind first. Even if we're going to meet somebody, we think about that person. That person's come into our mind. Now, if we're going to meet somebody and there's a problem, then our mind goes around like, ooh, how are they going to react? Is this going to be harmonious or is this going to be stressful? Are they going to be nice or are they going to be nasty? If we are looking forward to meeting someone and we have built this wonderful anticipation, and then we meet someone and they don't meet our expectations, they're a little off that day or they're not totally giving us what we expected, then we start judging and we start saying, well, gee, wonder what's wrong with them, or maybe what's wrong with me, what did I do that someone reacted this way? Now, when you're aware of all of this, awareness is power. Because if you're unaware of it, then you're just being pulled back and forth by these feelings, by these beliefs, and by these concepts, and by this action and reaction. But when you're aware of it, then you can go into a situation and say, oh, this is coming to me that this could be contentious. What is that saying to me? Well, let's cut that concept right here. Let's go into the truth. What is the truth? Consciousness. This one infinite life. My consciousness and your consciousness is the same. There aren't two consciousnesses. There is just one. So when I'm going in to meet someone and I'm not projecting my concept about who they are or what they are going to do, and I'm completely centered, then I'm going into the presence of this one consciousness. And that's harmony. Love is the activity of it, so there's harmony. But if you're not aware of your mind working this way, you're just functioning in this reactionary state of mind. So we know ourselves. Don't be afraid to examine your conditioning. There's no judgment about it. If you were raised in a real redneck place in the South and your whole family were highly prejudiced and you've moved out and you think, gosh, I don't want to be prejudiced, but I see somebody of a different race and there's something that happens in me, don't be afraid of that. Realize, oh, conditioning. Conditioning has no power. I can be completely free. I mean, that just is a very obvious kind of thing, but it could be about health. Raised in a family that was always fearful of disease, always preventing, wanting to prevent disease, always, oh, if don't go into that place because people are sick there. What if you get bit by a mosquito? What limitation? When you find that kind of mental thought process, you have to consciously say no. You are that individual, that consciousness, that looks at this whole world that supposedly defines who you are, and you have to break it apart. You have to blow it to bits. Because that's not who you are. That is a concept based on time, based on ancestry, based on mythology. Now, most of the examples given are negative. What about human good? What about the beliefs that I was raised in such a great family, we were liberal, we were healthy, we were wealthy, everything was going, you know, we were lucky. You know, that's my conditioning. The world owes me everything. Well, if it's coming from this world, if it is coming out of the mind, it's no different than the negative. And somewhere in the back of your mind is, gosh, I've been so lucky in my life, everything is so wonderful, when is it going to stop? When am I going to have problems? Fear. Oh. Fear is the greatest hypnotist in this whole mental realm. And what is it based on? I'm going to lose my good, I'm going to lose my life, I'm going to suffer. Buddhism was all about, developed about suffering. Why do people suffer? Why is there suffering? Is there a way to not suffer? Where Christianity is all about achieving, have that mind in you that was in Christ Jesus. So all these human cultures are all striving to access consciousness. For what purpose? Now here is one of the big sticklers. If we have an agenda of accessing consciousness for human good, to alleviate suffering, we've missed the point. I'm going to leave you with that. And we'll take our break for lunch. But think about that. Human good and human evil, they're the same, they're the opposite ends of the same stick. Why callest thou me good? There is no good but consciousness. Okay, thank you.